And welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm your host as we come your way every Sunday at 7 a.m. and p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We are archived at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. We also stream at richarddugan.com. And the click to listen banner is there. You can't miss it. I guarantee you. It says click to listen, so you shouldn't have any problems. We also link to our guest's website, and I think that you're going to get a kick out of today's program. I've had the distinct pleasure of being in on an interview that this woman who is our guest today was a part of. And it was so intriguing to me, and I felt it so important for us to talk about this, especially considering the fact that I grew up in a more of a matriarchal family than patriarchal. And there are times when I would actually prefer that. You heard back in the 90s the phrase, a kinder and gentler whatever. Well, in a matriarchal society, I think you might get that. But there's some sternness, too, I know, because I've actually, at least on one occasion that I can recall, I have actually been slapped in the face by my mother for something I should not have said. Enough said. My guest, who you hear chuckling there, Dale Griffiths-Stamos, she is the co-author, along with her brother, Scott Griffiths, Ren Woman, What Modern Renaissance Women Have to Teach Us About Living Rich, Fulfilling Lives. And I want to thank you, Dale, for joining us on the program.
Absolutely. Pleasure to be here.
This subject of women, and of course, one of the questions that always seems to come up when talking about, shall we say, I think the right term is gender-specific conversations, is that transition point in an individual's life, regardless of gender, when they transition from childhood to adolescence to adulthood. And what that really means. And in many other cultures, as we've talked about, there are rituals, there are ceremonies for those transitions. I used to run down a laundry list of those rituals or ceremonies that determined here in our country and in our society those transitional points. And for men or women, for that matter, do you become an adult when you reach the age of 16 and you first learn to drive, or 18 and you get to vote, or 21, or when you get married, or whatever the case may be? For me, and I remember doing so much research on this that I actually had to acknowledge that I didn't become a man until I was 33. When I had a specific experience with another gentleman in a wilderness setting where I basically was able for the first time in my life to stand up without anger, without lashing out, and stand up for myself and say, no, stop. This is where I get off. Okay. And I, even the words that I spoke to this gentleman were, you are not my teacher. I'm not your student. You are not my father. I'm not your son. Mm-hmm. Okay. And in spite of all of the things that he said to me that I did have to acknowledge, it didn't change that fact. So I'm curious, let's kind of start at that point, because we will get into the aspect of, you know, people have heard of Renaissance men, but the term Renaissance women, not so much. And we'll get into that. But let's talk a little bit, if we can, about those milestones for the female part of our society.
What was interesting about what you just said, and I don't have all of the details of your experience, obviously, but it was very interesting to me that you faced up to someone, and as you put it, in a non-violent way, non-anger-based way, but in a calm, clear-headed way, and acknowledged that you were who you were, and that man was who he was, and that, in fact, there was no... there was no connection between those two, that you acknowledged that you were a different human being and that he was not someone to influence you. I don't think that female turning points are too much different than that. I think that women also have points in their lives. And yes, they sometimes come early. They sometimes don't come till much later, in which they define who they are, not only as a woman, but mostly as a human being. where they stop listening to the messages given to them by so much of society, by their own family, and they start to strike out on their own and say, wait a second, I don't think that message applies to me. Mm-hmm. I think, in fact, I'm this. Mm-hmm. I define myself as this, which is one of the reasons I explored the women in this book who all self-define. And so I think that we do come to those kinds of points in our lives, you know, where, you know, we're influenced by school for much of the time. We're influenced then by our first jobs for much of the time. But there is a certain point where I think most mature women, and I don't mean that in age, mm-hmm. I mean that in maturity, decide that they have a path. They have a personal path to follow, and that that path is defined by their own definitions and not by others. And to some extent, what you were saying about becoming a man seemed to have many of those same qualities.
It's interesting to think about the various other cultures that have those rituals. I mean, right. The first one that comes to my mind is the Jewish tradition of the a bar mitzvah, or I guess the mitzvah for
right,
women,
right.
At the age of 13.
Bat mitzvah, yeah.
Bat mitzvah. And that in in the bygone days, if not hundreds or thousands of years ago, within the Jewish tradition, when that transition point came about, that milestone came about, the society treated that individual as a man.
Right.
Not in ours.
Mm-mm.
Not today.
No.
They're still 13 years old.
Yeah. They're still a child.
They're
very
still,
much a child.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's how they're treated.
Yeah. And, of course, you have the primitive societies where, you know, that's where you have the boys taken out. As soon as they hit puberty, they're taken out into the forest
yeah.
and they're thrown out there with a knife, and there's usually a circumcision ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And there is that turning from childhood into adulthood, and females in various societies have similar type of rituals, not the barbaric practice of female circumcision, which is absolutely horrific, but a type of female passage.
Right.
It's this idea of passages. You know,
yeah,
a wonderful
yeah.
book was written years ago by Gail Sheehy called Passages. And it really acknowledged for both men and women the, you know, the different phases that we all go through in our lives. There was, I don't remember who the philosopher was, but there was this concept that we have the age of discovery, we have the age of education, we have the, and then we finally reached in our last years, we reached the age of contemplation, and where we can actually contemplate the deeper values of life. I would argue for being able to contemplate those deeper values all through one's lifetime. We certainly need it now in our world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's for some of us, it is sort of a frustrating time. And I have always expressed my appreciation of my parents and to my parents for what they have given me in my life. Even at the time that I received both of their last wills and testament and read through it and said, okay, I mean, you know, what do I care? It's their stuff.
Right.
You know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's their whatever they have. If they want to spend it all, that's fine. It's
right.
theirs.
Right.
It's not mine.
Right.
I'm not entitled.
I know.
You know. But at the same time, they've given me so many intangibles. That have made me who I am. Even when they have acknowledged their perception of mistakes that they made in my upbringing, that you know they felt. I remember hearing my mother say that she felt badly because they couldn't protect me from the bullies in school. That kind of thing. Well, what parent can? You know,
yeah.
unless you homeschool and you keep them locked away,
right.
that's the only way you can protect them, and that's no life. They
yeah.
don't. You know, you don't grow up socially. But anyway. So I'm greatly appreciative for what they've taught me, and I have never spoke disparagingly about either my parents, my mother or my father, my dad, and I really do look at it this way. They did the best that they could with what they knew at the time.
Right.
But they never stopped learning. And really, that's, I think, maybe what you're talking about in the book, Wren Woman, in terms of women, because that's what our focus is today,
yeah,
who refuse to just stop and just become the homemaker or become whatever it is that society wants them to become.
Right.
And I find it interesting. It was a few weeks ago that I just happened to watch the movie Suffragette.
Oh, right.
And of course, I'm coming from a 21st century mindset. When I'm watching these men, granted a movie, but of real events, I'm sure, going, how can you treat these women this way? Not only are they women, but they're fellow human beings. They're fellow citizens.
And you all had a mother.
And you all.
That's what amazes me. You all had a mother.
Yeah. There's such a disconnect in my head to that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's boggling to the mind, to mine anyway. There are a lot of things that I can't wrap my head around. And
you know, it's interesting because one thing I noticed, and this is the important role of men in women's lives, one thing I noticed about a lot of the women in the book and in my own life as well is the relationship, the very positive relationship that they had with, usually with their father.
Mm.
Not as much with their mother. You know, I came from a traditional household where my mother was a housewife. But my father, who was an intellectual, a PhD, Middle Eastern specialist, recognized my intelligence very young, and he mentored me.
Mm.
And that mentorship made me feel from a very young age that there wasn't any difference intellectually between men and women, and that there wasn't any difference between what I could accomplish versus what, you know, my brothers could accomplish, because I was treated with that level of equality.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the—and the other thing the women will say about the men in their lives is choosing the right man with whom to partner.
Oh, yeah.
Choosing—well, you know, I have this thing in the book called Wren Gems, which are these bits of wisdom at the end of each chapter, which are quotes from the women. And Dale Franzen, she's another Dale, another female Dale, which I loved. But Dale Franzen, one of her Wren Gems was choose your spouse wisely. And that is, I can't tell you how true that is, because I chose my spouse extremely wisely, and having an enlightened man as a spouse, and there are plenty of enlightened men out there, is one of the best ways to flourish yourself as a woman in the various things that you're pursuing in your life.
Mm.
So, yes, so that's really essential.
Well, it's interesting because my first marriage, I'm not exactly sure how it happened. I'll be honest with you. I mean, it was just a series of events that just kept going. And it was one of those things that, as I look back, I couldn't stop.
Mm.
It just kept moving. And 15 years after, I said, enough is enough. I can't do this anymore. And then when I began to pursue the next relationship, and I was kind of counseled in this, I wrote a list of things. I literally wrote down in a little notepad the things that I wanted in the relationship and from mm-hmm. another woman.
Right.
Well, it turns out she had done the same thing.
Well, that's intentionality.
Yeah.
You know, that's really important. I did something similar before I met my husband.
Yeah.
You know, it's intentionality.
And at the same time, there are still no guarantees.
No, of course not.
But by the same token, it really is about your perspective of all of these things. Because for the longest time, and it was really kind of at the time, it was a little disappointing. I was listening to this one gentleman who put out these marriage seminar tapes and so forth. This goes back to the 80s.
Mm.
And I used to listen to this thing. Wow, this sounds really good. You know, I mean, for the most part, it was from a very religious perspective. But again, the general principles, I like that. That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
One in particular was having to do with resolving an argument and forgiving.
Mm.
And he used to use the example of, because he was also a therapist, he'd have the couple in his office, and he would ask them, he says, so who do you think, which one of you do you think should forgive first?
Oh.
And, of course, the people would just look at him like, well, you know, she should and he should.
Right.
And he said, you should, looking at both of them, saying, whoever you are, you should forgive first.
Right.
Or if you're listening to the tape, it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it was directed at whoever is in the dynamic, you know. And so I kind of like that, you know, because it's like there is no step one, step two. It's together. You have to, if you're going to have the relationship.
It's together. There was an expression, I love it. I don't even remember where I heard it, but would you rather be right or happy?
Yeah, exactly.
I love that because, you know, I was telling a girlfriend that who was having trouble in her marriage, and I said, well, would you rather be right than happy? And she hesitated. because she wasn't really sure about that one. And when that finally hits home, I'd rather be happy. I don't need to be right.
Yeah.
You know.
And speaking of happiness, I find it interesting, and I muse about this, although I've heard all kinds of different explanations. In our Constitution, it talks about we have having the right to life and liberty, but not to happiness, to the pursuit thereof, but not to happiness.
Right.
Well, why isn't it then you have the right to pursue life and you have the right to pursue liberty and you have the right to pursue happiness? No, you have life. Well, if you're alive, you have life.
Right.
Liberty, that's a whole other juxtaposition because now it's a question of do you have somebody that is subjugating you and so forth? You might have it on a governmental level. You might have it on a religious level. And you may have it on a relationship level in terms of a husband and wife.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, going back, you know, and a lot of people feel like, oh, we want to go back to the 50s. Well, there you're talking about a subjugation a dynamic that we don't want to go back to.
No.
In spite of the level playing field that we would ideally like to have, where do you see women in our society here in the second decade of the 21st century?
You know, it's interesting because I think we're at a transitional point. I think we're in a place where, as I would put it, women are coming into their own in a way that they haven't before. We had glimmers of it, you know, and I talk a lot about that in the book about the women upon whose shoulders we stand. But what's happening more, and I really notice it with my son's generation, you know, I'm one of those mothers who brought up a son to think differently than, you know, the men that came out of my generation. But I think women today are starting to say, wait a second. That whole issue of can I have it all is still in play, still very much in play.
I think one of the problems with that, particularly, and I'll let you continue, is what the hell is all?
Right. Well, I think if you asked a woman what was all, she actually would be able to tell you what that is in her mind. Because for most women, what that means is a balance. This is the tricky part. The tricky part is the balance between having a personal domestic life and having a very rich professional life. How do you balance those? And men traditionally have not had to ask themselves that question. That's being asked by more men now, which is good. But traditionally, it has been very clearly divided in that the women were the ones who bore the children, and therefore they were the ones who took care of the children and had that responsibility. And very often, as an outcropping of that, they took care of the home, hearth, house, all of that. And once women's liberation came along, feminism came along, women were able to now pursue, you know, most every career they wanted to, glass ceilings notwithstanding, and inequity in salaries notwithstanding, they were still able to go out into the world and do all of these things. Now, one of the things that I talk about in the book, and that is underlined by a lot of the women, was that only half of the feminist revolution actually happened. And that was the half in which women felt they could go out into the work world and perform at full capacity and be respected for their work.
Mm-hmm.
But the other half, which is taking care of children, which is so essential to a woman's personality, but I will argue also essential to a man's personality. But men have been programmed that they have to be at work, and that the even if they long to be with their children, even if they want to be there if their child is sick or whatever, that they've been, you know, socialized to stay at work, that that is the more important thing.
Mm-hmm.
Women, on the other hand, have that need to go home and be with the child. Now, one could argue that women have that maternal instinct, and I would not argue against that. But the problem is it can't be such that women are so desperately trying to do it all. And the all is all of that, is both the domestic life, the child-rearing life, very often taking care of one's elder parents.
Mm-hmm.
That falls on women. All caretaking aspects of a family dynamic tend to fall on women. Meanwhile, they're putting in as many hours at work very often as the men in their lives, and they are getting 4 hours of sleep at night.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things one of the women in the book said, she said, you know, lean in. You know, there's the whole controversy about how women should lean in. Well, as she put it, she says, we were the lean-in generation, and we were exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't just about leaning in. It's about so much more. It's about an equitable society on a multitude of levels where both women get liberated, but also men do.
Yeah.
This is a partnership relationship between men and women.
And there's a big difference between equity and equality, because equality connotes a level playing field. And equity has more to do with an individual's place, if you will. I've been working in this industry for almost 40 years. And I would rather hire a woman. And I, in one of my positions back in Phoenix, I that's what I tried to do. Now, some might say, well, that's reverse discrimination. I don't care. Because a lot of the guys that I was hiring were dumber than rocks. They didn't get it. And they would argue, well, you guys don't pay me enough to clean the toilets. Yeah, but that's one of the tasks in this at this station in what we do here. That's part of the job.
Right.
Now, my wife, my present wife, she works. And we have no children, but we have animals, so the equivalent of children. But we both take care of them. I mean, I could go down the list. Okay, here's my personal series of events, my schedule in the morning, starting at 6 a.m. Okay, and by 7:30 we're out the door and in the car and coming down the hill. And then in the afternoon, we have the same set of schedules, unless I've got something that I have to do here at the station, and so forth. She hates doing laundry and she hates doing dishes. So one of the things that I have taken on in my morning schedule is, and I have a series, I have a path that I follow, and doing the dishes is one of them. Because if it gets done every day, they don't pile up and they don't become a mountain, right, and insurmountable. And I am, maybe it's because of my upbringing, because of the five women in my family. On the one hand, I wouldn't have a problem with, you know, staying at home and working from home and taking care of and doing this and that and the other. My issue is with stepping into her realms and moving things around and you know, disorganizing it from her perspective to organize it for mine.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right, yeah.
And because I wouldn't want someone to come here into the radio station and start moving stuff around.
Well, it comes down to those agreements, like you said, in my own marriage, my husband is the cook, and therefore he does all the shopping.
Yeah.
You know, we just have a very, very equal partnership. But he, you know, he just retired from being an attorney, but he had an extremely demanding job. And so, of course, there were things I had to take on in the raising of our child that he couldn't. But as much as he could be involved, he was.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things that we really talk about in this book, and this book is very – most of the women I know who write me and tell me they've read this book and what it means to them is that it works on both an inspirational and an aspirational level. It's inspiring in the same way that any story about remarkable people is inspiring. But it moves beyond that because the way it's aspirational is that – I got a wonderful email from a woman who basically said, when I read about these women's lives, and these are not famous women. These are women who generally, until you read the book, you may not know their name.
Right.
You know, we have an icons chapter where we talk about Maya Angelou and we talk about Oprah Winfrey and others. But the profiles are not. And what she wrote me, I just was so pleased to hear, because she said, when I read these stories about these women, I think that my goals are attainable. I think that I can go after my dreams. In fact, I want to even more than ever. You know, I feel that I can, whatever the obstacles in my path, and there were plenty of obstacles in the path of these women.
Mm-hmm.
This idea of equity and things being the revolution coming around to a more dimensional place than it's been is very valid. But what's inspirational about these women is they worked with the world that we have. They worked within the world we have. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Lydia Kennard is really interesting. She ran LAX during the 9/11 crisis.
Oh, wow.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So, you know, she got the phone call, you know, that the towers have, you know, the planes have gone into the tower, and she had to deal with a possible terrorist threats to LAX. But the thing about her is that she's a woman of color, and she basically, you know, found ways to just work around that, work above it, work around it, work under it.
Yeah.
And I'm not arguing that we need to continue to have a world in which there's prejudice and obstacles placed in the path of people of color or people of a certain gender. But what is inspiring about these women is that they said, screw it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
They said, you want to put that in my way? Fine.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll burrow through it.
Yeah.
I'll climb above it. And that, I think, is the inspiring part, is that they were just so driven. And, of course, they're Wren women, which means that they also said, I'm going to change my skin anytime I want.
Yeah.
If I want to have this career, I'll do this. But, gosh, I have a passion for this. I'm going to do it.
You know, has been said that we will finally come of age when, for example, we elect officials at whatever level, up to and including the president, where we stop referring to he is the first or she is the
That's
first
right.
kind of stuff.
That's right.
Because you don't hear that. Like, for example, Andrea Merkel. I think that's how you pronounce it.
Angela Merkel.
Angela.
Yeah, I believe it's Angela.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
You don't hear her being referred to as the sixth or eighth female leader of Germany.
No, and what's funny is this is our first possible female, and other countries have been way ahead of us on this for decades.
One of the things that I found so fascinating about this country as I take a look at our history and the history of the rest of the world.
Yes.
Is that the United States mentality seems to be, we don't care what you've done. We're going to do it on our own. Matter of fact, we're going to put the blinders on so we can't see what you've done.
That's right.
So that we can screw up instead of, hey, could you come over here? I'm trying to make something here, and I call it a blah, blah, blah. And you guys did it before. Can you give me some pointers? I don't want to steal your patents.
Right,
okay.
Right, right.
We just want to have an eye. No,
maybe
we
learn
won't.
From
we
you.
Just won't do that.
Yeah.
We're a country that's made up of people from all of these other countries.
Yes, of course.
Around the world.
Of course.
And that's how we were built.
Right.
And we refuse to access that incredible information, if you will.
It's an isolationist attitude, and there has been that form of isolationism in our country for a long time that has fought with the more global international view. I speak a number of languages, and what's interesting about that is very few Americans do.
Oh, yeah.
And very few Americans, if they do, speak well. My French is fluent, and I sound almost like a French person. And when I travel to France, they're literally shocked that I'm an American. But my argument is that if I go to a country and I speak to them in their language, rather than force them to speak in mine, the communication that happens, the personality of that person that I'm talking to gets revealed in such a more authentic way than were I to force them to come to me in my own language.
And the real irony is that in this country, and I know this from some of the things that some of the people I've talked with, California specifically, for example, the ballot that is printed in not one, not two, not three, no less than eight different languages. What does that say about the people who come here and want to be a part of this great experiment, the land of opportunity, and yet they refuse, for whatever reasons, to learn the language of the country that they want to be a part of? Because when my wife and I went to Ireland, I got to tell you, at first I was really concerned because I don't speak Gaelic.
Gaelic.
I don't speak Gaelic.
Yeah.
But thank God they did speak, and most of the people speak both Gaelic and English.
Yeah.
So there wasn't a real problem.
No.
And I have no problem understanding people with an Irish accent speaking English.
Right.
That's
right.
That's not a big deal for me. So yeah, it's that juxtaposition.
Mm-hmm.
I think
a lot of it, to tell you the honest truth, I really think a lot of it has to do with when that immigrant comes to our country and at what age.
Yeah.
And I think the children of the immigrants, this is not an issue.
Yeah.
The children of the immigrants learn English. I mean, that's what they do. But I can tell you, as a former language teacher and a language learner, that when someone comes to a country after the age of, let's say, 25, learning a new language is extremely difficult.
Yeah.
And so I have some sympathy for that.
Sure.
But I do also agree that one should make absolutely every attempt to learn the language of the country in which you reside.
But I would also say, on the other side of it, that if you're an individual who speaks another language and you're living here learning English, don't lose your foreign tongue.
That's right.
Because a lot of people, they do that.
My husband, Greek-American, well, he's half Romanian-American and half Greek-American.
Mm-hmm.
And he's literally half and half, where his grandparents on one side came from Greece, his grandparents on the other side came from Romania. His father grew up speaking Greek, but he never taught it to his son.
Oh, wow.
And we go and see Greek relatives on a regular basis. And my husband, I learned some Greek because I've got the language ear. But my husband cannot speak Greek for the life of him. And that frustrates him that he wasn't taught Greek.
I know baklava.
Yes.
I know opa.
Opa.
And
opa.
Efaristo.
Efaristo para poli. Right.
I used to produce back in the 80s, I used to produce a 1 hour, or was it an hour and a half, the Greek Family Hour.
Ah.
And I was always invited to the Greek festival that they held there in Phoenix. And it was really interesting, too, because the husband was Greek.
Uh-huh.
And I'm pretty sure that the wife was not, because if she was dyeing her hair blonde.
Uh-huh. Right.
But it was a lot of fun. I mean, I didn't understand when they would do their news in Greek. I don't know what you're talking about, but then they would translate it into English, so they'd go around again.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to come back. We're going to go into Renaissance Woman, and Ren Woman is the title of the book. We're talking with
Ren Women,
plural. Yeah. We're talking with Dale Griffith Stamos, and we're going to continue here on a program. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay tuned.
Tell me your story.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, and I'm in his studio with Dale Griffith Stamos, and we're talking about her latest work, the subject matter, Ren Women, and the subtitle is What Modern Renaissance Women Have to Teach Us About Living Rich, Fulfilling Lives. That is the direction that, of course, many of the programs that we do here talk about, and that is going beyond just surviving. You want to really survive? You really want an experience of survival? Go live in Alaska in the wilderness. That's survival.
Right.
You got to cut your own wood. You got to kill your own food.
Right.
You've got to find a way to stay warm in the winter and away from the fires in the summer and so on and so forth. That's survival.
Right.
Our society in which we live, we hear about living from paycheck to paycheck, whether one person's earning it or two. We call that survival. That shouldn't be survival.
Right.
We should be thrive. The word I love is thriving, but living a fulfilling life.
Yeah.
No question about it.
Yeah. It's a level. It's a what do we call it? A first world issue.
Yeah.
You know, I sometimes will look at problems and say, you know what, we have first world problems. We don't have third world problems, where it really is, where is your next meal coming from? Or will you survive, you know, the terrorists who are in the hills trying to shoot you? But in our society, in the USA and in many Western societies, we have evolved to this point where survival is not the issue any longer. But what you're talking about, living paycheck to paycheck, is not, well, it's still an issue for many, many people.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, how can you live a fulfilling life? Mm-hmm. When I say a rich, fulfilling life, those are loaded words.
They are.
Rich, not in the sense of wealth, but rich in the sense of depth and dimensionality. Fulfilling, not in the sense of how much money you're earning or how successful you are in the eyes of the world. Fulfilling in the sense of how meaningful is your life? How much are you affecting others in your life?
Yeah.
One of the things I have these women, I looked at these women in terms of, is how they define the word success.
Mm.
And they define it in a much different way than many people might do. There, you know, Arianna Huffington, whom we have in our opening chapter on the icons, you know, she wrote a book called Thrive, and it was based on the fact that she was pursuing success at the level of, as she puts it, money empowered. And at one point, she completely collapsed from sheer exhaustion and cut her head and went unconscious. And when she woke up from all of that, she went, I need to reevaluate what it is to be successful in life, not just in terms of society's, you know, opinion of me. And she completely redefined it and added all of these other dimensions. Well, that's what these women are very much about. They're about saying life is not just this thing called success. Life is this multifaceted thing called pursuing one's passions,
mm-hmm.
and for these women, those are many passions, called feeling that you have a rich family life. This is an extremely important component, whether these women have children or whether they just have good family lives in terms of their siblings or their parents. Also, for almost every woman in this book, it's about giving back. It's about finding a way to give back to the world. And many give back when they are intensely busy in their own lives. But they still give back because of the importance of doing that. Many of them mentor younger people. And then just finally saying, you know, what matters in life? I'm not going to go into the politics of the day, but what I think Trump represents is an ossification of certain male values taken to a very warped extreme.
Mm-hmm.
And I will argue and have in this book, I noticed in one of your former interviews, you spoke to someone who had been in the film Femme, Women Healing the World.
Mm-hmm.
And I, two of the women in my book, or is it three? Two of the women in my book were also in that film. And I've spoken to Emmanuel Etier, who is the filmmaker, frequently. But what his argument was, and also what the argument of a book that I quote in the book called The Athena Doctrine, they both argue for the need for a shift into female values. And in The Athena Doctrine, they had actually interviewed and done surveys in countless countries, including extremely macho countries, and they had listed what they perceive as female values: cooperation, empathy, understanding, connection, communication.
Yeah.
Notice how many C's are in there. That's interesting. all of these, and they didn't say they were female or male necessarily, I believe.
Yeah.
But they said, these are values. Would you like to see these values in your leaders?
Yeah.
And even the most machismo countries would say yes.
Yeah.
We want to see these.
You know, there's a sort of dovetailing off of that. I am hearing, I actually heard this from a gentleman, and I was kind of surprised that he said it. And he said it publicly. And I mean really publicly.
Yeah.
He acknowledged and almost proudly that he was a misogynist.
Oh.
And I'm thinking, are you kidding me? Really? Now, I grew up in a household with five women, okay? And as a male, yes, I love women. I love the female form. I love what they offer. I love the nurturing. I love all of that. But, for example, if I'm walking down State Street and I am coming upon some beautiful women that I deem attractive,
right.
I may glance at them, but I keep going straight ahead. I don't turn and look back to get another view, okay?
Right.
Because if I didn't, if I didn't get an eyeful from the front,
Yeah.
Now you're, from my perspective, now I'm crossing the line.
That's right.
Now I'm glaring or ogling. Now
you're objectifying.
Objectifying.
That's, yeah.
But at the same time, I don't know, is there anything wrong with whether it's women appreciating men and vice versa, men appreciating women to, let's just say, that extent?
Well, this is an interesting question because—
I mean, how far?
Where is the line? And I think that's what confuses men more than women these days. It really confuses men, and I am sympathetic to that because I think the rules got changed at some point, and the men are not always sure what the playing field is anymore. But I will say that there was a really interesting, I think it was on Facebook, but it was one where they tracked a very attractive young woman walking down the streets of New York City, I think. And they kept track for, I don't know, maybe an hour and a half, how many catcalls and how many obscene gestures mm-hmm. and how many, oh, baby, baby, mm-hmm. you know, were thrown at her. And it was shocking to see how often this happened. When I lived in France as a 21-year-old, there's an expression in French called draguer. And draguer means to try to pick up women in the street.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was highly offended by the amount of aggressive, assertive behavior on the part of men. But having said that, sure, women want to be appreciated
yeah.
for how they look. And sure, men want to be appreciated for how they look. And there is a subtle way of doing that. I think the way you described was just lovely. I mean, that idea of looking at someone saying, yes, I like what I see. I don't yet know what your brain is like. I don't mm-hmm. yet know what your personality is like. But I will say on first look.
You can be dumb as a rock for all I know.
Yeah, you can be dumb as a rock, but I appreciate what I see.
Yeah.
And I think that women are feeling more free to be able to do that, you know, yeah. about men, too. That is part of being, you know, normal human beings.
When I would go through personal growth programs back in the 80s and 90s, and I would walk in the first night of these intensives, I would look around the room and I would say, I'd like to get to know that person and that person. And again, this is all obviously based upon a visual appraisal.
Right.
And by the end of the weekend, by day five, Sunday afternoon, the people that I was connected with or that I was associating with and friends with and so forth were absolutely the people that I wrote off on Wednesday Wednesday night.
Yeah.
So, oh, no, I don't. And the people that I looked at around the room that first night said, yeah, I had nothing to do with.
No, because looks are not everything. Exactly.
And there was even one woman uh-huh. who was so put off, not that I had shared this, you know, perspective, but she was just so put off apparently by what I was putting out energetically that, you know, because at the end of the whole weekend, you know, everybody was kind of friends, right? And you're all around hugging, right?
Yeah.
I went through three different programs with her, okay? Never, and to this day, did I ever receive any kind of physical contact, even just a hug, let alone a handshake from this woman. I thought, wow, I must really represent something that she doesn't want to have anything. And that was really the way I had to put it. I had to, I couldn't personalize it.
Right.
I had to say, there's something that I represent for her that she just doesn't want to have anything. And I understood that and I accepted that.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, they talk about you can't judge a book by its cover. That is true
mm-hmm.
because you don't know what's inside that package.
You know, when I was a girl, it's interesting because I think because of my relationship with my father, I really had no perception of myself as an object of men's attention. I've always been in my brain, and I've always been, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point I began to realize, you know, in high school and so forth, that I was becoming that object of. And, you know, there's a wonderful book by Simone de Beauvoir called The Second Sex. It was a seminal book in feminism. And it's that concept of the objectification of women by men or by society. Well, the truth is, nobody wants to be an object. Everybody wants to be the subject,
mm-hmm.
the subject of their own lives.
Yeah.
And I always felt like the subject of my own life. You know, some mothers would tell their daughters things like, you can't let a boy think you're smarter than him.
Mm.
Or you can't let a boy, you have to let a boy win at tennis or win at whatever game you're playing.
Yeah.
You know, and these are such wrong-headed messages because it makes men feel superior when, in fact, they're not,
yeah.
you know, and it makes them feel intimidated by intelligent women. But there's that fine line where, for a long time, men were feeling very angry at women who seemed to be too aggressive, too assertive, and would be called, you know, the B word instead
right.
of,
right.
you know, and that's still getting negotiated.
Yeah.
You know, that's still,
yeah.
you know, how assertive can a woman be without suddenly people finding that objectionable?
Yeah.
You know, whereas, again, you can have the men be as abrasive as they want to be,
yeah.
but the women have to toe a closer line.
And, you know, that's interesting. And then, of course, this was a male that I had this association with back at this other station. He was from Mexico. He came in, actually, he and his partners came in suits. I mean, beautiful, beautiful
right.
suits. I'm
right.
just immaculate. And they came in, and my first observation of them was, God, these guys are arrogant. Oh, my God, these guys. One of my coworkers, who is Spanish, she's an American citizen. She's born and raised here, but her heritage is not Mexican. It's Spanish.
From Spain, yes.
And she says, he says, you're wrong. That is not arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
That is confidence.
Oh.
That's the difference.
Hmm.
See,
yeah.
I perceived it as such because these guys came in knowing what they wanted.
Right.
Well, what's wrong with knowing what you want?
Right.
You know.
Right.
And so it's the same argument for women.
Yeah.
I would much rather now. For example, my wife, she will receive certain compliments at work from coworkers or her supervisor about the work that she does.
Right.
And it's wonderful because she and I say, take that in. And so when we're chatting, when we're out in the backyard playing with the dogs and we're chatting about these things and she'll share that, I says, you know, I know how that feels. I can relate to that, you know, and I will share with her an example from mine. But see, coming from me, it's like I don't have to work at it sometimes. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, I suppose in a way I do, but you know, it's because I enjoy what I do. I love what I do. I have a lot of fun with it, and I try to have fun with people and really interact with them in a positive way, in a productive way, in a cooperative way,
mm-hmm.
not a confrontational way.
I have a hard time sometimes. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a hard time sometimes understanding these divisions that come up between men and women. I have two really close friends who are men,
mm-hmm.
and I have several close friends who are women. And, you know, I'm of the belief that, you know, whether I don't know if I believe in reincarnation or anything of that nature, but I do believe that all of us have traits that are feminine and all of us have traits that are masculine
mm-hmm.
and that we can meet in those places.
Yeah.
I don't think there's as much division. I think there's a huge spectrum of men, a huge spectrum of women in which you find men who are gentle and sweet and kind and nurturing, and you find women who are assertive, aggressive, you know, ballsy and
mm-hmm.
and ready to, you know, take on the world, and you find everything in between.
Yeah.
And why, you know, it's the same thing in the rest of our society with its incredible divisiveness. It's not allowing for the fact that there are so many grays. There are so many permutations of things.
Yeah.
And so many places where we all really could meet if we weren't defining things with these absolutely razor-cut labels that, you know, are not what it's about. But on the other hand, you know, and one of the things I celebrate in the book is there are things that women can bring to the table, be it their upbringing, or be it the fact that they are women, and there are certain things that we have, you know, even brain-wise, you know, cooperation between the right brain and left brain,
right,
through the corpus callosum,
mm-hmm,
all of that kind of stuff, that we do bring to the picture,
yeah,
that we need for society. You know, there's a book called How Women Lead by Sharon Haderay, and I forget the name of the other co-author, but the different style in which women lead. And one of those things was demonstrated by something that happened when the government shut down. And what was that?
Yeah.
That was like, we had like 16 days or something like that where there was a government shutdown.
I've heard this story before.
Yes. And a woman, and I have it in the book, but a woman senator, I'm going blank on her name, but a woman senator who was a Democrat went up to a woman senator who was Republican. And of course, now the two sides do not, you know, meet for lunch anymore. They used to, you,
yeah,
know, there used to be a time where they were cohorts and,
yeah,
you know, they may have been on a different side, but you conversed.
Yeah.
And they met for what she called a pizza party. And they all sat together and they said, okay, we're from both sides of the aisles. Isn't this ridiculous that we're shut down? Let's figure it out. And they brought a solution back to Congress, and that's the solution that was adopted. And the women said, well, the difference is that it's not about ego for us.
Yeah.
For the men, they were saber-rattling, and they were saying, I'm right, you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
For the women, it was, there's a problem, how do we fix it?
Yeah. Which is usually, in a rational male mind, the process. We're,
yes,
always trying to fix stuff.
Yes,
but
exactly.
Women don't want us to fix stuff in the relationship. They want us to listen.
Yeah, that's a whole other issue.
That's a whole other thing.
But that's about communication.
That is
and
true.
And see, that's,
yeah,
another thing women bring to the table, a form of communication,
mm-hmm,
which is empathetic usually in nature.
Yeah.
Well,
I tell you this, I wish we had more time, and I would love to have you back to do part 2 and 3 and 4, because, you know,
yeah,
we could go on for hours. I encourage you to pick up a copy of the book, Ren Women, and the website, the best website for them to go to.
Okay, the best way is to go to www.renwomen.com. You can also go to our Facebook page, which is Facebook.com/RenWomen. There's Twitter.com/RenWomen. We are available on Amazon in the paperback form. If you want a signed hard copy, you should go directly to our website where you can get a signed hard copy instead of the paperback available on Amazon. And the Kindle version, by the way, will be coming out in about a week.
I like the strand of letters,
yes,
currently queuing around here, starting. You've got Oprah and Roosevelt and,
yeah,
so forth. You have these different names.
Yeah.
Turn the book around to see all these.
You
but
see all the names. We
it's
have
really
both some of the icons, some of the historical, and some of the profile names on,
very
on
interesting.
The cover.
RenWomen.com. RenWomen, what modern Renaissance women have to teach us about living rich, fulfilling lives. Before I let you go, I have three final questions for,
yes,
you. And again, my guest is Dale Griffiths. Stamos, Dale Griffith Stamos. And again, we thank you so much for sharing so much time with us. Who is Dale Griffith Stamos?
Well, I would like to claim a little Wren-ness myself. I have pursued a number of things in my life. I started out as a linguist with a master's degree in Romance languages. I was teaching French and some Spanish for a number of years, but I'd always wanted to be a writer. I published my first poem at the age of 9,
mm,
so I've always written. I pursued songwriting for a little while.
Mm.
I play both guitar and piano, and I write music. But in my early 20s, I went into the field of writing that has been my principal form of writing for many years, which is playwriting, and I've had a number of plays produced throughout the country. And more recently went into screenwriting, adapting some of my short plays to short films, and those have gone to festivals throughout the country, won some awards, which is lovely. And then this book project came along. It was my brother's idea, and because he'd done a book before that on modern Renaissance men, So he brought me into this project, and there I was changing hats yet again. Mm. And, you know, and I also, by the way, I teach writing at the Santa Barbara Writers Conference. I teach story structure for all genres, and I consult writers. So I'm busy in a lot of different of a absolutely funny 5-year-old and the wife of an app.
So let me ask work that you are doing now.
Well, in that case, it's funny because I was talking to someone, which was an interesting idea. But the idea of women then have allowing women to move more fully into the world of politics and all other fields in ways that can have a healing effect. And I hope that this book, in showing the inspiring stories of these extraordinary women, can help move us towards that kind of society in which women get to sit at the table in full collaborative ways and bring their women gifts to the scene.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
You know, as a writer, I think my life's purpose is to communicate. I am a deep thinker. I have been in everything I've written. I'm also a deep questioner, and that is seen in a lot of what I've written.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm appealing to that side of people who are searchers, who are questioners, who want to try to understand life at a deeper level than just the surface.
Mm.
So I want to deeply communicate with people. I want to touch their minds, their hearts, and their spirits. That is my goal as a writer.
Well, Dale Griffith-Stamos, thank you so much for joining us on the program and introducing us to Wren Women. I encourage you to go to the website, wrenwomen.com, check out the book, check out all kinds of great information and all the different things that Dale has done in particular. And again, thank you for sharing so much time with us.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to all.